By 1953, the straitjacket of Stalinist terrorism had become absurd, absolutely intolerable for every single section of Soviet society. And all of its elements yearned to throw it off, from the top bureaucracy to the outlying nationalities. It had become a break on the economy, culture, and science. I need only recall to you the fact that through the dictates of Stalin, relativity was dismissed as an idealistic aberration, that the genetics of Lysenko was exalted over that of the more scientific line of development. Freudian psychology was downgraded, and so on. Workers were fined and could not move freely from place to place without a passport. There were millions of people in labor concentration camps. The terror had become senseless from any point of view. However, there was no organized opposition. Every potential source of resistance of a political character had been annihilated in the 1930s. Sometime you should read the eyewitness account of how the last bands of Trotskyists in Stalin's isolators in Siberia, 12 to 1300 of them, were led out in batches and shot in the snow. But despite this political atomization, the pressure for reform was so immense and irresistible that it had to find an outlet for itself, as happens when you have an immense head of steam in a boiler without a safety valve. It became a life and death question for every single element in the Soviet Union. And so it took, as the only available outlet, the bureaucracy itself, or certain elements within it. And so it was that after Stalin's death, while they hesitated and began to back and fill, in 1956 they made the decision through the Khrushchev faction that the time had come to demolish the Stalin cult and disclose some of the crimes of Stalin and assure the Soviet people that this was not going to go on or to happen again. And I believe that the same thing is going to happen in China. I don't know when. Could happen in 6 months, could happen in 6 years. It depends upon the development. The first thing that any opposition will have to do in China is demolish the cult of Mao Zedong in order for the country to go forward, because it's a shackle on every aspect of Chinese life today. The bureaucratic reforms of the Khrushchev period had an extremely ambiguous character. Isaac Deutscher, I think, has very well depicted their dualistic nature in a number of his writings, including his latest book, The Unfinished Revolution, which I recommend to you. It was a form of enlightened absolutism, enlightened only in respect to the obscurantism and terror of its predecessor. But it did throw overboard the worst, most abominable and intolerable features of Stalin's despotism. The concentration camps were dismantled. The universal terror was relaxed. The Soviet people no longer feared the knock on the door at night. Labor penalties were cut down and even abolished. A few more people could go abroad. The secret police was bridled. Then material concessions were made to the workers. There's been a bringing together of the extremes of income. The situation has become easier for the intelligentsia, especially those in the natural sciences who have the most freedom of expression today in the Soviet Union, much less to the novelists, the playwrights, and so on. More recently, the collective farmers and the farm population in general are being given greater considerations. But with all these reforms, there has been no easing of the monopoly of political power. The bureaucracy holds on to this with a death-like grip because it is a life and death matter for them. They even say that they propose to do that all the way to the achievement of communism. Lenin, you know, talked about the withering away of the state, but they have told the Soviet people that the present state power is going to remain as strong as it has been. It is going to hold on to its powers and its privileges so long as it is able to do so. So long, that is, as there is not mass resistance to it. Now, on the international arena, Khrushchev has extended, deepened, and even made more explicit Stalin's course of conciliation with imperialism, and has shown an equal fear of independent revolutionary movements through the policy of peaceful coexistence. Now, what are the perspectives of further development so far as the Soviet Union is concerned? It is passing through a period of internal liberalization, which has run up against insurmountable limits and is beginning to exhaust itself. It's clear that the more alert and cultured sections of Soviet society are not at all content with the way things are going, although their hopes have not yet been completely blasted. Just look at this one instance. The present year is seeing the celebration of the 50th anniversary of the October Revolution. Now imagine a Soviet historian or a youth trying to make sense out of the official version of Soviet history. The Stalin version, he has been told, is falsified and has been scrapped. But a true new version has not been presented to them. Full attention is going to be focused on the October Revolution, but the leader of the insurrection was a man named Trotsky. He not only led that insurrection, but he wrote the clearest and fullest Marxist exposition of it in the history of the Russian Revolution. But it is a state crime for a Soviet citizen to have that book in his possession. So, at the very time of the celebration of that world historical event, the Soviet youth and its intelligentsia are not in possession of any accurate depiction of it. And this is a country that is supposed to be guided by historical materialism. I remember C. Wright Mills telling me that he was a guest of the Soviet government just before his death. And as he left the Soviet Union, the leading sociologists and philosophers held a dinner for him. And they chided him for not being a Marxist and not going far enough along Marxist lines in his writings and in his ideas. Well, he was a very bold fellow and had had a couple of drinks in addition. He was leaving the country anyway. So he got up and he told them, "How do you dare chide me for not being a Marxist?" He says, "I know more about Marxist thought than any of you do, because I have read Trotsky's works, and you are not permitted to read them." And he was the most original and creative Marxist thinker in the 20th century. And unless and until you are freely permitted to publish and read and study Trotsky's work, you're in no position to criticize me or to call yourself a free country. What could they say? Another American professor, he wasn't a C. Wright Mills, but Professor Louis Freya, wrote, he spent about 4 months in the Soviet Union talking to all its philosophers. And he would ask them all the same question. How do you explain the cult of the individual? And he said the invariable answer he got was, "That is not my department." And he never got any explanation of it. Now, it isn't that they don't feel restive under this situation. They know that it's an impossible condition to remain in. But nevertheless, the lid is still on them. Now, both Moscow and Peking show in their own way that although Stalinism has been hard hit and its future is not bright, it's far from dead. Its pernicious influence have to be combated, its ideas exposed, and its development brought to light. I believe that it's hopeless and retrogressive for Peking to try to salvage the cult of Stalin and to uphold his road as desirable. And even worse, to set up alongside it or even in its stead the cult of Mao Zedong. This offends the whole rest of the Soviet bloc, who might be attracted by its militant stance on some other questions, especially in the field of foreign policy and the colonial struggle against imperialism. The dynamism of de-Stalinization leads logically to a return to Leninism, and the motto for the Soviet countries ought to be back, not back to Stalin, but forward to Lenin. Now, what is the way out for the communist countries? The only way is through the strengthening and victory of the socialist forces in the strongholds of imperialism. This will, in the first place, remove the pressures and the threats of attack from which the worker state suffered from their birth. And then their peoples can confront their bureaucrats without any fear of foreign intervention and consummate the drive for democratization. In the second place, the taking of power by the workers in the more advanced countries would provide resources for lifting them out of poverty and material inequality. And I feel quite certain that the victory of a workers' revolution in any of the major advanced countries would give an immense impetus to the de-Stalinization processes and open up very different perspectives for their internal development. I believe, moreover, that a powerful Trotskyist movement in the United States would have tremendous repercussions in the communist countries, not to speak of what it would do for the whole movement of the Fourth International. And of course, a victorious socialist revolution in this country would remove the last external prop of bureaucratism elsewhere in the world. Stalinism can go in the Soviet Union even before that, if the masses can complete the anti-bureaucratic revolution that is in preparation. We would gain a great deal from that, because the strongest argument against socialism has been Stalinist totalitarianism. Socialism, before Stalinism, used to be associated with freedom and democracy, and quite honestly and fully so. The curse of Stalinism made it identical with tyranny. And this has deterred the progress of the socialist cause, especially in the Western world. And we have had to suffer tremendously from the crimes of Stalinism as a result. Now, what has been the significance of the fight led by our movement internationally and nationally against Soviet bureaucratism and its Stalinized movements? First of all, we provided a Marxist analysis of the phenomenon. I don't know how quickly the workers' movement would have been able to arrive at an understanding of this very complex and contradictory phenomenon if it did not have the exceptional good fortune of the survival of Trotsky, who had followed the course of the Russian Revolution his entire life in all its principal stages, its rise and its decline, and was able to apply the tools of Marxist analysis to arrive at the correct theoretical and practical conclusions in regard to it. Our movement not only provided a scientific appraisal. It told the truth for 40 years about what was happening in that country under the dictatorship of the law. It saved the honor of world socialism. It helped prepare as much as it could for the new rise of an untarnished and unfalsified socialist movement. It gave a program that has been realized in some measure, but is there as a guide for present and prospective struggles. Now, nothing less than the end of imperialism and an orientation toward a socialist democracy will eliminate all those conditions which enables bureaucratism to flourish in the workers' movement. And that is the objective to which our party and movement in this country is dedicated. I want to end on a somewhat more personal note. There are some of us here to whom this is not simply history. It was a very tragic and ordeal and a terrible experience fighting against the advance of the Stalinists. Let's simply take the 1930s to go back no sooner. Can you imagine what it meant as we watched Stalin frame up and murder all the living members of Lenin's political committee while we were accused of being in league with Hitler and the Mikado, poisoning children, wrecking railroad trains, committing all sorts of nefarious crimes with hardly a publication which would give voice to our denial. To be in a very small minority against the powerful onrush of the colossus of Stalinism. Nevertheless, there were many comrades, not a few of whom fell in that battle, who stuck by their posts and did their historical duty, and that's part of your heritage. And you can, I think, be very proud of it. Now, we have lived through the rise and decline of Stalin. Your generation, hopefully, will see the fall of this plague and the full sanitation of the world labor and socialist movement. But in order to complete that process, you will have to understand the nature of the Stalinist phenomenon, to its very marrow, and then proceed to get rid of its last vestiges. And if these talks have helped you to do that to any extent, well, I've made another little contribution along that line. Before we proceed with questions, I'm looking for something that I've placed. Ah, here it is. Before we proceed with questions and discussion, as you know, there are certain expenses involved with having comrades from the center coming out to various areas of the country to help in the education of our movement in the summer schools that we're holding. And
Evelyn Sell, the organizer of the branch, has just informed me earlier today that the bill has come in from New York, which we have to meet, and has asked that we all put in a contribution of at least 50 cents, and in that way that we can meet that bill. Okay, let us then proceed with questions and discussion.
Yes. With regard to Chinese foreign policy, since they did that, the attitudes of Stalin and the methods in some respects, how was it that they were not able, as was the Soviet Union, to maintain or to establish faithful satellites as Russia was, and specifically in the case of North Korea?
When the Sino-Soviet breach began, there was widespread sympathy for the Chinese side, not only in the ranks of a number of the communist parties, but also among the communist governments. And among them was North Korea. What repelled North Korea was the same that severed relations between the Japanese Communist Party and Peking and Havana and Peking, and also caused coolness between North Vietnam and Peking. The Chinese are ultra-factional and extremely sectarian and overbearing, whatever their motives. And they demanded that every communist regime 100% endorse everything that Peking said and did in its struggle with the Soviet Union. Now, some of these countries couldn't go along with that. Others wouldn't, because not only for economic, military reasons, but because some of the policies adopted by Peking were disastrous and untenable. The central one being its refusal to urge or to practice any form of united action with Moscow in defense of the Vietnamese Revolution. And this was found intolerable by Havana first and most of all, and then by the North Koreans. And when they sent their representatives to Peking, these representatives were told, if you don't endorse us 100% and do as we do and echo what we say the way the Albanians do, then you are nothing but tools of the revisionists, and we'll denounce you accordingly. Now, this is not simply hearsay. There was a delegation, there was a meeting of communist parties in Havana, communist parties of Latin America, and they sent a delegation, I believe it was 64, to Peking to see Mao Zedong and talk over the split in an attempt to ameliorate it. At that time, the Cubans had sympathy for Peking. And Mao and his advisors took this stand. But when the report of this discussion, the stenogram, came back, the Cuban leaders were appalled. It was incredible to them. And they thought maybe because
The Cuban representative was Rodriguez, who was a leader of the old Cuban Communist Party. But possibly they didn't trust him. So when Che Guevara took his last round-the-world trip, he stopped off in Peking and asked for an audience with Mao Zedong. And Mao Zedong refused even to talk with him. And that's the background of the break between Havana and Peking.
Could you say something about the role of bombs in the in Korea during the Korean War and also today? You never hear anything about it. And from what I've seen, Korea is really a very important country. Since residing with Cuba, major issues.
Well, at the present time in the field of foreign policy, there is a special tendency among the communist governments which embraces North Korea, North Vietnam, and Cuba. They have the most enlightened and advanced policy in respect to the defense of the Vietnamese Revolution. The internal regime in North Korea is, of course, not as good a one as in either Cuba or North Vietnam. But it has made immense strides in many fields since the devastation of the war. And it remains to be seen what the further development of that regime is going to be. And that will depend, too, upon whether this bloc of three states remains intact and whether this, in turn, will have repercussions within North Korea. It's a possibility, but it's not an actuality as yet.
What role does Donald play in that role?
Well, it was a what you call a client state of the Soviet Union by agreement with Washington and London. That is, at the end of the Second World War, with the defeat of Japan, they just arbitrarily sliced Korea in half. And the Soviet Union was awarded jurisdiction over the northern half and the Americans in the south. And that's why Korea is split to this very day. And under the shelter of the Soviet Union and its armed forces, the same type of regime grew up in North Korea as in Eastern Europe. It wasn't the result of an independent mass revolutionary struggle. And he remained under the Soviet patronage all through the Korean War, and is still considerably dependent upon the Soviet Union economic and even to some degree militarily. But like all the other client states, it's regained more and more independence, especially because of the development of the Sino-Soviet conflict. And Moscow can obviously no longer direct it to do this or to do that and expect them to snap into line.
You'll often hear people coming up to the comrades and saying, oh, are you a Trotskyite?
When I was in Vancouver, I was booked to speak on the most popular call-in program there.
and they informed me that the master of ceremonies was a roaster of reds, and I better be prepared for a rough, tough time. Well, we started off, you know, this way. He said, "Mr. Novak, I understand that you're a Trotskyite." And I said, "No, I'm not." He said, "Well, then what are you?" I said, "I'm a Trotskyist." And of course, I took this from Detroit. He said, "Well, what's the difference?" I said, "Well, there's as much difference between a Trotskyite and a Trotskyist as there is between a socialite and a socialist." This gave me a psychological advantage over him from the start, but it softened him up. He thought that was a great joke. He had me on for a full hour, and then the fellow for the next hour came in and asked me to spend another hour. And Trotskyism got the fullest exposure it's ever had in British Columbia as a result. And then I explained that Trotskyite was a term given to us by our opponents, and we don't accept it. We designate ourselves as Trotskyists, although we are Marxists, revolutionary socialists, and would prefer that term. But we're quite proud of our association with the one of the two foremost leaders of the Russian Revolution and opponents of Stalinism. Yeah.
How much do you think the latest world outlook with statement by the Dominican CP to the effect that parliament, that representative democracy is worthless and that the struggle should be done for workers and peasants problem. How much significance would you attach to this term?
Well, the break with the Moscow policy is of great symptomatic significance. It shows how radicalizing the events in Latin America have become, and how powerful the radiation of Castroism has become. It is a direct result of the disillusioning and dismaying experiences that the Dominican radicals have gone through since the fall of their dictator. Now, how far and how fast the Dominican Communist Party will go in a revolutionary direction is indeterminate. But they are moving to the left in a very sharp and swift way. And again, that depends upon both internal developments and the strength of the movement led by Olas. Well, I just want to say that that's not an isolated occurrence. There is now a line being drawn through all the communist parties in Latin America as to which side they're going to be on, behind Castro or behind Moscow.
America's road to capital, America's road to socialism by James Buchanan. He talks about the policies of Stalinism in the post-war period and the developments of the Eastern European countries. And he states that conception of the Marshall Plan by the American government was an important factor in compelling the compelling Stalin and Soviet Union to allow the transformation of the Eastern European countries into worker states. Could you go into specifically how the Marshall Plan affected Stalin's politics in that direction?
Well, it may be hard to visualize now, but the Soviet Union was terribly impoverished by the Second World War. And Stalin attempted to drain whatever wealth he could out of the surrounding occupied countries in order to build up the ravaged economy of the Soviet Union and to keep them in a dependent position. He did not have at that time the resources to reconstruct the satellite economies. And the Soviet strategists no doubt feared or figured that America, with its immense wealth and resources, would, with its loans, get control over first the finances, then the economies, and eventually the governments themselves of Eastern Europe, as they were able to do with the governments of Western Europe, and dictate to them or exert enough pressure on them so they would not become pliable servants of Moscow's aid. And in order to fence off East Europe from the penetration of American capitalism and its pressures, he decided that the time had come to get rid of both the capitalist property and the pro-capitalist politicians, so that their governments were reorganized and thoroughly Stalinized as a countermeasure.
So in the present day China, there's a civil war going on. Both factions seem to be Stalinist. What would be the possible outcome?
What would be the possible outcome of the civil war in China? I can't answer that question. I just don't have enough facts, and the reports you get are not reliable. And until we get a clearer picture, and are quite sure what is the substance behind these reports, what the programs and direction of the different factions and tendencies are involved, I think it would be rather risky for us to take any kind of a definitive position or make a positive evaluation of it one way or the other. And that's why I at least am waiting and watching to see. China is the most enigmatic and least known country in the entire world today, although it's the largest. We follow the world press and try to get hold of every possible bit of information, but it's not easy to know exactly what the situation, the forces, the trends are in that situation.
Since one state in India, in Bengal, in most of the lower regions of the Himalayan region, the people, peasant revolts have taken place, and they have distributed land among themselves. Can this lead to socialist revolt? So the section leading the revolt is the Communist Party, but it's totally patient-oriented, not worker-supported.
Well, whether or not a peasant revolt will move forward depends upon what support it gets from other sources, as well as how strong are the counter forces that are hurled against it. So I'm, in this particular instance, I don't know enough about the situation there, and I do believe that the unrest along India's borders as a result of the socialization measures in Tibet and what has happened in China has induced the Indian bourgeoisie to build up the border incidents and whip up national chauvinism against China and try to send more troops into those areas, because they are afraid of the spirit generated by the Chinese Revolution penetrating into the northern provinces of India. And this would be one manifestation, a repetition of it.